Welcome to the History Maps podcast. The King of Ava bows low to inspect a legendary sword presented by his most trusted minister. And in that exact fraction of a second, the minister raises the blade and strikes the king dead.
Yeah, it is a very sudden, very visceral moment of betrayal.
Right. And in one bloody moment, an entire empire effectively shatters. So today we are exploring the Kingdom of Ava, which was a dominant political and cultural force in central Myanmar from 1364 to 1555.
Right. And the mission of this deep dive into the sources is really to understand how a kingdom built on the ashes of a fallen empire used extreme hydraulic engineering, relentless warfare, and brilliant cultural patronage to unite a fractured region.
Yeah, only to completely collapse under the weight of its own decentralized system. I mean, if you have ever tried to hold together a complex project with multiple highly independent stakeholders who all secretly want your job, the successes and brutal failures of the Kingdom of Ava offer a profoundly relevant historical parallel for you.
Absolutely. And to really grasp the mechanics of how the Kingdom of Ava functioned, we first have to look at the geopolitical void from which it emerged. So if we go back to the late 13th century, specifically around 1287, the region experiences a catastrophic systemic failure.
A failure brought on by the Mongols, right?
Yes. A series of Mongol invasions drive south and cause the absolute collapse of the pagan empire. Up until that point, you know, the pagan empire had successfully unified the Irrawaddy Valley for centuries. They were the unquestioned central authority.
But those Mongol incursions just completely shatter that administrative structure. It's gone.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And importantly, when the Mongol forces eventually withdraw back north, they do not leave a puppet government in place. They just leave a massive, gaping administrative vacuum.
Which means you have a sprawling, highly organized empire that essentially evaporates overnight. The central authority just vanishes from the map. But order is inevitably restored somehow. I mean, what are the actual mechanics of a region rebuilding itself when the capital falls? Who steps into that kind of void?
Well, the reorganization of power is immediate and intensely localized.
Right.
Geopolitics functions much like nature, right? It absolutely abhors a vacuum.
Right. Someone's going to take charge.
Yeah. And in the immediate aftermath of the Mongol withdrawal, we see localized warlords and ethnic coalitions stepping up to claim control of their immediate surroundings. The most prominent example the sources give us is the Mayan Singh Regency,
which was established in 1297, I believe.
Correct. And this was governed by three Shan brothers, Athinkaya, Yazathingin, and Thihathu. Now, they were not outsiders conquering a new land. They'd actually been senior commanders under the old pagan court.
Oh, so they already had the infrastructure.
Exactly. They simply utilized their existing intact military resources to secure a permanent foothold in the central agricultural zone while everything else around them was falling apart.
I see. So it's less like a shattered mirror and more like a collapsed dam. When the central dam of the pagan empire breaks, the power does not just disappear. It rushes down into the valleys and pools into smaller, disconnected lakes.
That is a perfect way to visualize it.
Yeah, and each of those lakes represents these petty kingdoms, Mayan Singh and later Pinya and Saging. And because they are confined to the same geographical basin, the water levels are constantly fluctuating. They are in a perpetual state of friction over the exact same resources.
That analogy of the collapsed dam illustrates the dynamic perfectly. The three brothers initially managed to pool their resources and hold a substantial territory together. But dynastic ambitions inevitably split their domains within a single generation.
Because of course they do.
Right. By 1315, the political map shows the Kingdom of Pinya controlling the eastern bank of the Irrawaddy River, while the Kingdom of Saging controls the western bank. They basically lock themselves into a cycle of localized attritional conflict.
Just fighting back and forth across the water.
Exactly. And because they are expending all their military energy fighting each other across the river, they render themselves entirely incapable of securing their northern frontiers.
And that northern frontier is not quiet. I mean, they are facing continuous pressure from northern Shan raids coming out of powerful principalities like Mogong and Munin.
They are. And it is crucial to understand the specific nature of these raids. Initially, these were not prolonged wars of territorial conquest.
Right. They weren't trying to take over.
No. They were highly organized seasonal extraction campaigns. The Shan forces from the north would wait for the optimal season, sweep down into the central valley, systematically pillage the agricultural wealth, capture skilled labor, and then deliberately retreat back into the hills before the heavy monsoon rains arrived.
Which is just a brutal cycle to live through.
It is. This relentless cyclical pressure steadily degraded the central kingdoms. By 1364, the cumulative damage of these raids culminates in the complete and utter destruction of both Sogang and Pinya. The Central Valley is left thoroughly devastated.
Which brings us to the rise of Thado Minbya. The sources place him right in the middle of this absolute chaos in 1364. He is only 18 years old, a leader of mixed Chandramese descent.
Right, just a teenager, essentially.
Exactly. And within a highly compressed time frame, he manages to rally the panicked remnants of the Sagan court, executes a rapid military crossing of the Irrawaddy River, and outright seizes Pinya. He immediately executes the rival ruler, Uzana II, and marries the chief queen, Saw Oma, consolidating his power.
It's an incredibly bold sequence of events.
It really is. Now, the traditional chronicles frame this entire sequence as an act of supernatural destiny. They portray him as this divinely appointed figure meant to unify the realm. But looking at the timeline, how does an 18-year-old execute a military and political takeover of this scale so quickly? What is the practical mechanism of his success?
Well, the historical reality is far more grounded in brilliant pragmatic opportunism. Thado Minbya fundamentally understood the specific mechanics of the Shan raiding system we just talked about.
He knew they wouldn't stay.
Exactly. The northern Ma Shan forces had just utterly devastated the region. They even carried off the reigning king of Pinya. But true to their operational model, they did not stay to permanently occupy the lowlands. They gathered the spoils and retreated north.
So he just waits them out.
Pretty much. Thado Minbya watched this tide recede and immediately moved to capture the resulting power vacuum before anyone else could organize.
So he is not necessarily fighting a massive entrenched army. He is moving quickly through a devastated landscape to claim the political center, while the rival Pinya court is entirely leaderless and paralyzed.
Precisely. He possessed the crucial advantage of mobility and decisive, even ruthless leadership at a moment of total paralysis.
Yeah, executing the rival king is pretty ruthless.
It is. By immediately executing Uzana II, he permanently removed the figurehead of the rival faction. And marrying Queen Saw Oma was an equally calculated maneuver. She had been the chief consort of the last three Pinya kings.
Oh, wow. I mean, that is a serious political resume.
Right. So by taking her as his queen, he bypassed years of potential civil war and secured immediate dynastic legitimacy among the surviving, highly fractured nobility.
So he secures the crown, but he decides not to rule from the ruined capitals. He builds an entirely new one. And his choice of location is highly deliberate. Thado Minbya selects a site right at the confluence of the Irrawaddy and Maitenge rivers.
And this decision demonstrates a profound level of strategic foresight. He recognized that the old capitals were geographically vulnerable. The site he chose for his new capital, Ava, was initially a vast, inhospitable swamp.
A swamp? That sounds like a terrible place to build a city.
Well, it was, until he changed the geography. To make it habitable and defensible, he had to initiate an immense campaign of hydraulic engineering. He mobilized vast labor forces to systematically drain the wetlands. They excavated a massive network of canals that physically connected the two rivers, effectively carving an artificial island out of the landscape.
Wait, I want to clarify the scale of this. In 1364, draining a major riverine swamp and digging interconnecting canals is an operation requiring tens of thousands of manual laborers moving earth by hand. He is essentially terraforming the region to create a fortress.
It is a staggering mobilization of human capital, especially for an 18-year-old new king. By turning the capital into an island, he created a formidable, permanent natural moat against the very land-based invasions that had just destroyed Sogang and Pinya.
That's incredibly smart.
Yeah, and furthermore, the specific geographic placement provided direct, highly defensible river access to the Kyoxi district.
Right, the granary.
Exactly. Kyoxi was the primary granary of Upper Burma. It was an intensely irrigated region that produced massive rice surpluses. In the context of the 14th century, control of the Kyoxi granary directly translated into control of the regional food supply.
And food is power.
Unquestionably. That surplus was the foundational currency needed to raise, feed, and sustain large professional armies.
And the actual urban design of the city is deeply tied to the psychology of power, too. The city was officially consecrated on February 25th, 1365, under the name Ratanapura, meaning the City of Gems.
Yes, the sources emphasize the rigorous cosmological design of the capital.
Right, the outer walls were built with a distinctive barrel shape, which local tradition states was intended to outline the mythical Chintha lion, a recognized guardian figure. But the inner citadel is where the true messaging lies.
How so?
It was meticulously laid out as a physical manifestation of a miniature Buddhist universe. The central palace complex was specifically positioned to represent Mount Meru, which is the sacred, immovable center of Hindu-Buddhist cosmology. He is quite literally building a physical argument that his political authority is anchored in the divine architecture of the universe.
It is an architectural declaration of supreme, centralized authority. He is telling the surviving factions that his rule is not merely a political reality, but a cosmological necessity.
Which is a very hard claim to argue with.
Exactly. Yet, despite successfully engineering the physical and ideological fortress of Ava, Vito Minbia dies suddenly of smallpox in 1367. He is only 21 years old, and crucially, he leaves no direct heir.
A 21-year-old builds the cosmological center of an empire and then abruptly dies. I mean, the kingdom could have easily fractured right back into those disconnected lakes we talked about.
It absolutely could have.
But the geographic and structural foundation he laid was apparently robust enough to survive the shock. The physical fortress of Ava was secure. But the next ruler had to figure out how to build the economic engine necessary to turn a fortress into an expanding empire.
Right. And that task fell to his successor, Swasa K, who takes the throne in late 1367. Swasa K recognized that military expansion was impossible without a massive, reliable agricultural surplus.
So he doesn't immediately go to war.
No, his immediate focus was not on launching foreign campaigns, but on domestic public works, specifically dirt and water.
He looks at the map and realizes that before he can march armies, he has to fix the plumbing of the entire region. The sources extensively document his focus on hydraulic restorations across the dry zone.
Yes. He initiates vast restorations of the ancient irrigation networks that had fallen into critical disrepair during the decades of political fragmentation.
Mm-hmm.
The sources specifically highlight his massive renovation of Maiktila Lake and the complete reconstruction of the Zidau Weir in the Kiox district.
Which feeds right back into that granary control.
Yeah, exactly. By systematically repairing and expanding these specific water networks, he dramatically increased the water retention capacity of the dry zone. This allowed for reliable, multi-season rice cultivation.
More rice means more money.
And more soldiers.
Yeah.
The resulting agricultural boom translated directly into massive state revenue. It provided the deep logistical capacity required to continuously fund, equip, and provision the military apparatus that Ava would soon deploy.
And Ava was going to need every single grain of that rice because Swasa K was steering the kingdom into what would become a multi-generational geopolitical nightmare.
The 40 Years' War.
Right. The entire era comes to be defined by a massive structural rivalry between two distinct powers. In the north, you have the Kingdom of Ava. Ava is a land-based agrarian powerhouse relying on the irrigated rice fields of the dry zone.
And in the south?
In the south, dominating the Irrawaddy Delta, you have the Mon Kingdom of Hanthawaddy Pegu. Hanthawaddy is a maritime, trade-focused power that controls the highly lucrative coastal ports and access to the broader Indian Ocean trade networks.
The strategic tension between the two is structural and inevitable. I mean, Ava views itself as the legitimate successor to the old pagan empire. Therefore, they believe they have an inherent right to control the entire length of the Irrawaddy Valley straight down to the sea.
They want that port access.
They need coastal access to participate in international maritime trade. Hanthawaddy, conversely, has grown incredibly wealthy through that trade and views its independence as an existential necessity. They have zero interest in becoming a subservient vassal to a northern agrarian king.
And this fundamental incompatibility ignites the 40 Years' War. The spark comes around 1385, and it is catalyzed by internal politics within Hanthawaddy.
Right, a succession crisis.
Yeah. A new king, Razadarit, takes the throne in the south, and he immediately faces a severe rebellion from his provincial lords. One of these lords, a southern viceroy named Lakpia, who controls the Myongnyur region, sends a formal invitation to Ava.
Which is basically asking for an invasion.
Exactly. He essentially asks Swasa K to intervene militarily, depose Razadarit, and absorb the delta. Swasa K views this as the perfect legal pretext to launch a massive invasion south.
And the defining characteristic of this resulting war is how intensely it was governed by the environment. The logistical mechanics were entirely dictated by the seasonal shifts of the monsoon.
Right. The weather dictates the war.
Absolutely. The operational rhythm became brutally predictable. Ava would launch its massive offensives during the dry season. They would march tens of thousands of infantry down the dry river valleys, heavily supported by cavalry units and terrifyingly effective corps of war elephants.
That sounds unstoppable.
During the dry months, it kind of was. The terrain heavily favored Ava's sheer numbers and heavy shock troops.
But a dry season always ends. I mean, put yourself in the boots of an Ava infantryman who has marched hundreds of miles south. When the monsoon rains hit, the entire operational reality changes. The delta effectively turns into a vast, flooded swamp.
Exactly. And Hantha Wadi brilliantly utilized the onset of the monsoon rains as their primary defensive weapon. They understood the terrain intimately. When the floods arrived, they utilized the dense mangrove swamps and their vastly superior naval flotilla to transition into a punishing war of attrition.
I want to focus on the mechanics of that attrition. How does a naval flotilla systematically dismantle a massive land army? Because Ava is trying to maintain a supply line that stretches over 1,000 kilometers from their granaries in the north down into the hostile delta.
Well, that 1,000-kilometer supply line was Ava's critical vulnerability. In the pre-industrial era, moving thousands of tons of grain over land was logistically impossible. Ava had to rely on river barges moving down the Irrawaddy.
Which are sitting ducks for a navy.
Exactly. Hantha Wadi leveraged their highly maneuverable warboats to continually sever those riverine supply routes. They would intercept and destroy the grain barges. Simultaneously, Hantha Wadi employed ruthless scorched earth tactics.
Burning their own fields.
Yes, they would deliberately burn their own fields and grain stores ahead of the advancing northern army to entirely deny Ava's forces any local forage.
So the Ava forces are stranded deep in enemy territory. The river behind them is blocked by warboats, and the land around them is stripped bare.
And then the floods arrive. The lowlands inundate, rendering Ava's primary shock weapons, their cavalry, and the massive war elephants largely ineffective. I mean, you cannot maneuver a multi-ton elephant through deep mud and flooded mangrove forests.
That sounds like a complete logistical nightmare.
It was. Trapped in the flooded delta without reliable supply lines, the northern armies frequently faced mass starvation and rampant waterborne diseases. The environment itself forced them to execute disastrous, disorganized retreats northward year after year.
It evolves into a grinding, horrific stalemate that hollows out both societies. As we move into the early 1400s, the leadership on the Ava side shifts. King Mingkong I takes command, alongside his son, Crown Prince Minye Kyaswa. And Minye Kyaswa fundamentally changes the tempo of the war.
He does. He launches incredibly fierce, deeply penetrating campaigns against Rezidarit's defenses.
The historical sources uniformly highlight Minye Kyaswa as an exceptionally aggressive, brilliant tactical commander.
Yes, he recognized that the seasonal retreats were bleeding Ava dry, so he pushed his forces much deeper into the delta than any previous commander. During the grueling campaigns of 1414 and 1415, he managed to capture highly strategic towns deep in the south, placing the capital of Pigu under severe sustained pressure.
He was on the verge of winning it all.
He really was. He came remarkably close to breaking the Hantha Wadi defenses permanently.
But the reality of frontline combat catches up with him. In March 1415, during a major engagement, Minye Kyaswa suffers severe combat wounds, and he ultimately dies from those injuries shortly after the battle.
And the psychological and strategic impact of the Crown Prince's death cannot be overstated. It completely shatters Ava's offensive momentum. Minye Kyaswa was the engine driving the southern campaigns.
Without him, they just hit a wall.
They do. With his death, the deep exhaustion that had been accumulating for decades finally sets into the leadership of both kingdoms.
Because you have two major powers that have spent decades mobilizing their entire populations, burning their own agricultural bases, and losing tens of thousands of men to combat and disease.
It's totally unsustainable.
Right. By 1423, Ava is under a new ruler, King Thiathu. He attempts one final half-hearted invasion of the south, but there is no real military conviction left. The campaign simply fizzles out, ending not in a dramatic siege, but in a highly pragmatic, exhausted peace treaty.
And to cement this truce, Thiathu marries the Hantha Wadi princess Shinsa Pu.
Which is a very standard diplomatic move, but it shows they are just done fighting.
It does. And this conclusion forces us to examine the profound cost of their strategic fixation. Ava and Hantha Wadi lock themselves into a mutually exhausting, multi-generational stalemate. They expended vast, unrecoverable amounts of state wealth and human manpower for effectively zero territorial gain.
Decades of war for nothing.
basically. And critically, while Ava's political and military attention was entirely fixated on the southern swamps, they remained dangerously distracted from a massive geopolitical storm rapidly gathering on their northern border.
Oh, right. The northern frontier they ignored.
Exactly. The northern Shan states were reorganizing, and directly behind them loomed the rapidly expanding power of the Ming Dynasty.
So Ava has just spent decades grinding its economy to dust in the south. If I am a rival power looking at a map, I am no longer looking at the southern delta. I am looking straight at Ava's completely unguarded back door in the north.
And standing right at that back door is the Ming Dynasty, which pushes aggressively into the Yunnan province in 1382.
And the Ming expansion into Yunnan fundamentally alters the security architecture of the region. The Ming court understood that directly occupying the rugged, mountainous Taishan borderlands with regular imperial troops would be a logistical nightmare.
And prohibitively expensive.
Right. Instead, they implemented a system of frontier management known as the Tusi system, which formally translates to Aboriginal Pacification Commissions.
The Tusi system, yeah.
I look at the Tusi system like an aggressive corporate franchise model. The Ming court is the central headquarters. They do not want to micromanage every single regional branch, so they recognize the existing local chieftains.
They make them middle management.
Exactly. They grant them fancy imperial titles, hand them official gold seals of office, and declare them legitimate rulers on behalf of the emperor. But the franchise fee is mandatory.
Naturally.
These chieftains must send regular tribute to Beijing, and most importantly, they are legally obligated to keep the overland trade routes open and completely pacified. They act as geopolitical shock absorbers.
That franchise analogy is structurally accurate. The Tusi system allowed the Ming to project the aura of total imperial authority and secure the trade routes without the crushing expense of maintaining a permanent military occupation.
It's a smart strategy on paper.
It is, however. The inherent flaw in the system was its extreme volatility. It relied entirely on the continued compliance of local chieftains, who often possessed their own deep-seated imperial ambitions.
They aren't just going to blindly follow orders forever.
No. And this structural instability explodes into outright warfare with the rapid rise of Meng Mao, a territory known in the Chinese administrative records as Luxuan.
Right. Meng Mao is led by a fiercely ambitious chieftain named Fang Gambua. He has absolutely no interest in being a compliant Ming franchisee. He actively seeks to revive an older, massive Thai empire.
He wants to be the boss.
Exactly. By the 1430s, he begins launching highly destructive raids directly into Chinese territory, explicitly disrupting the very trade routes the Ming had installed the Tusi system to protect.
And you simply cannot disrupt the core economic interests of the Ming Dynasty and expect them to issue a polite diplomatic protest.
No, they sent an army.
A massive army. The Ming response is overwhelming. The imperial court dispatches General Wang Qi, who launches a series of massive, uncompromising, punitive campaigns known as the Luchuan Pingyin campaigns. The sheer scale of the Ming military machine is devastating.
They just roll right over them.
Basically. By 1441, Fang Gambua's forces are completely routed. His primary stronghold is systematically sacked, and he is forced to flee for his life across the Irrawaddy River. He desperately seeks political asylum in the neighboring Shan state of Munyin, which sits directly on the border of the Kingdom of Ava.
And this instantly drags Ava into a terrifying diplomatic standoff. Fang Gambua is eventually captured by the forces of Ava's King Naropati. The Ming army, fresh off a massive victory, arrives in force at the Ava border.
And they want their fugitive.
They issue a stark demand, surrender the chieftain immediately. But Naropati makes a wildly bold calculation. He does not just hand Fang Gambua over. He looks this captive warlord and sees unparalleled diplomatic leverage.
Yes, Naropati executes a masterclass in high-stakes diplomatic brinkmanship. He calculates that the Ming generals, despite their massive army, are far from their supply lines and deeply anxious to secure their primary objective and return home victorious.
They don't actually want to fight another long war.
Exactly. While in Ava's custody, Fang Gambua realizes his situation is hopeless and commits suicide in 1446. Naropati shrewdly takes possession of the corpse and uses it to extract massive geopolitical concessions from the Ming commanders.
The payoff Naropati secures is frankly staggering. By simply handing over a corpse, he is officially granted the title Comforter of Ava by the Ming court.
Which is a huge validation of his power.
Right. He receives a solid gold seal of appointment directly from the emperor. Even more practically, he secures direct Chinese military assistance to successfully crush a violent domestic rebellion in the Yamethan district.
a very useful perk of the alliance.
And finally, the Ming officially grant Ava territorial rights over Manyin. Naripati plays a seemingly weak hand perfectly to secure Ava's northern frontier.
He secures an immediate, brilliant victory, yes. But the specific terms of these negotiations contain a catastrophic oversight.
Oh, this is the part that comes back to haunt them.
Absolutely. The historical sources clearly document that while Ava agrees to hand over Thumgumbua's eldest son, Sijifa, to be transported to Beijing for public execution, they allow a younger brother, a man named Sibufa, to slip away and go free.
They let him go.
They do. This younger brother and his direct descendants continue to stubbornly hold power in Manyin, operating entirely without Ming approval. This seemingly minor diplomatic loose end leaves a fiercely hostile, deeply aggrieved lineage entrenched permanently on Ava's northern border.
Just stewing in anger.
Exactly. It is a lineage that will spend the next several decades methodically preparing to seek devastating revenge against the kingdom of Ava.
So if we look at the geopolitical map right now, Ava is defined by relentless, grinding warfare in the southern delta and terrifying diplomatic tightropes on the northern frontier. You would assume the interior of the kingdom is a grim, militarized camp.
It would make sense.
But if you actually walk the streets and visit the monasteries of Ava during this exact same period, you encounter a profoundly different reality. You find a society experiencing a massive, brilliant intellectual and cultural renaissance.
The contrast is truly fascinating. While the military is continuously engaged on the frontiers, the domestic core of the kingdom is undergoing a radical linguistic and cultural transformation.
The language is changing.
Yes. If we look back historically, during the preceding pagan period, the entire system of monastic education, formal literature, and legal scholarship was strictly conducted in Pali.
And Pali is an ancient language, right?
Exactly. Pali is the ancient classical language of Theravada Buddhism. It was an elite language, entirely inaccessible to the general population. However, under the specific patronage of the Ava kings, we see the deliberate cultivation and emergence of a highly vibrant vernacular Burmese literature.
Think about the impact of that shift. Imagine living your entire life where the laws governing your property and the religious texts explaining your universe are written in a language you cannot read.
You're completely disconnected from it.
Right. So the translation of complex Buddhist cosmology and intricate legal codes known as the Dhammathoths into everyday vernacular, Burmese, fundamentally changes the society. It pulls these massive concepts out of the closed elite monastic circles and makes them directly accessible to the wider population. Suddenly, you, the average rice farmer in the dry zone, can actually engage with the laws governing your own life.
And the historical record provides striking, quantifiable evidence of this societal shift. Detailed linguistic analysis of inscriptions carved in classical Burmese during the Ava period reveals a remarkable 3-to-1 ratio of commoner authorship compared to noble authorship.
Wait, really? Commoners were writing 3 times as much as the nobles?
Yes. We possess specific stone inscriptions featuring original poetry composed and carved by a Palong village headman in 1355. That level of literary production from a rural leader indicates a society where functional literacy and deep intellectual engagement are aggressively pushing outward, far beyond the confines of the royal palace.
And the state actively sponsored this democratization of knowledge, particularly during the reign of King Thihethera, who ruled during a relatively peaceful stretch from 1469 to 1481.
Yes. Thihethera dedicated immense state resources to the sponsorship of Theravada Buddhism and the direct welfare of the Sangha, the formal monastic community.
Why focus so heavily on the monks, though?
Well, Thihethera understood that in the Burmese political model, religious legitimacy and economic stability were inextricably linked. A culturally vibrant and economically prosperous populace possessed the necessary leisure time to engage in meditation, practice advanced artisanal crafts, and critically, provide abundant daily material alms to support the vast network of monks.
Oh, I see.
Supporting the Sangha was the ultimate demonstration of a successful, legitimate kingship.
And this deep religious focus dictates their international diplomacy as well. There is a deeply striking vignette in the sources regarding Thihethera's diplomatic outreach. In 1474, Thihethera and his chief queen decided to send a diplomatic gift to the Temple of the Tooth in Kandy, Sri Lanka.
Which was a major religious center.
Right. At this time, Sri Lanka is widely recognized as the absolute global center of Theravada Buddhist scholarship. But the King of Ava does not just send a chest of gold. He sends a highly personalized, profoundly symbolic object, A broom made entirely from the hair of the king and queen, fitted with an incredibly elaborate jewel-studded handle.
It's such a specific gift.
It is. And it was specifically intended to be used to sweep the sacred floors of the temple.
And that specific object is a masterpiece of diplomatic and religious signaling. By using their own hair, the king and queen are demonstrating the ultimate act of personal humility and physical devotion before the relics of the Buddha.
But it has a jewel-studded handle.
Exactly. Simultaneously, by attaching a handle encrusted with massive priceless jewels, they are loudly signaling the immense material wealth and undisputed royal status of the Ava court. The Sri Lankan religious authorities clearly recognized the weight of this gesture.
They sent something back, didn't they?
They reciprocated by sending highly venerated sacred relics back to Ava.
And Ava ensures the arrival of these relics is a magnificent public spectacle. The sources detail how the court commanded the construction of a massive temporary bridge made entirely of gilded boats stretched across the river to ceremonially enshrine the relics.
Just a bridge of gold boats.
It is a brilliant piece of political theater designed to legitimize Ava as a supreme, unassailable center of Buddhist piety in mainland Southeast Asia.
This soaring cultural confidence is fully articulated in the historiography produced during this era, too. In 1520, a brilliant scholar monk named Shin Mahasilavamsa compiled a text known as the Yazawin Kayo, or the Burmese King Supplement.
Which was a history book.
More than that. This document was not merely a chronological list of local rulers. It was a highly sophisticated ideological project. The text deliberately and systematically linked the lineage of local Burmese kingship directly into the much broader ancient Pan-Asian Buddhist tradition.
Oh, tying their local kings to the grand religious narrative.
Right. It provided a powerful intellectual framework that reinforced the concept of the Ava king, not just as a regional warlord, but as a divinely sanctioned universal protector of the faith.
So Ava is culturally wealthy, its literature is thriving, and its kings are viewed as divine protectors of the universe. The intellectual foundation is incredibly solid. But the mechanical political structure underpinning this golden age contains a fatal flaw.
A massive structural vulnerability.
Yeah. The exact system of governance that allows local culture and provincial autonomy to flourish so beautifully is also actively decentralizing the kingdom's military power. And this structural flaw leads directly to the absolute destruction of the state.
To understand the collapse, we really have to look closely at how power was actually distributed. The Kingdom of Ava functioned on what political scientists term a mandala political structure.
A mandala.
Yes. To conceptualize this, do not think of a modern nation-state with rigid borders and a massive, centrally controlled standing army. Ava was effectively a loose, highly flexible federation.
I think the mandala system operates much like a gravitational field. The closer you are to the capital city of the sun, the stronger the king's direct political and military pull. The center is tightly controlled.
But as you get further away.
Right. As you move outward toward the peripheries, local provincial governors and vassal chieftains operate like distant planets. They have their own distinct gravitational pull. They maintain their own autonomous armies, collect their own local taxes, and essentially govern themselves.
That gravitational analogy perfectly captures the dynamic. And it is important to recognize that this was not a conscious design flaw or a failure of imagination by the kings of Ava.
They didn't choose to be weak.
No, it was an absolute necessity dictated by the extreme geography and the limited technology of the era. The landscape of Upper Burma is dominated by rugged, impassable mountain ranges and dense, shifting river networks, projecting continuous, uninterrupted central authority from a single capital over that terrain was logistically impossible.
They just couldn't march troops fast enough to control it all.
The kings were forced to rely on powerful local strongmen to govern the distant peripheries.
But then how does the king actually ensure those distant warlords do not just march on the capital? I mean, if they have their own armies, what is stopping them?
Well, the center maintained control through a complex web of marriage alliances, lucrative economic patronage, and most crucially, the sheer personal charisma and proven military reputation of the reigning monarch.
So it's all based on personality and fear.
Essentially, yes. The vassals remain loyal because they believe the king was strong enough to crush them if they rebelled. But this system creates a massive vulnerability. Every single time a strong king dies, the entire gravitational field resets.
Oh, because the new king hasn't proven himself yet.
Exactly. The state faces an immediate, severe succession crisis. the peripheral vassals will inevitably test the new, unproven ruler's military strength by deliberately withholding their annual tribute or declaring outright armed rebellion.
And by the 1480s and 90s, you can see the gravity of the central court rapidly failing. Ava's grip on the periphery visibly weakens. The southern kingdom of Poem declares independence. Various northern Shan states openly break away.
The edges are fraying.
But the absolute critical blow, the one that seals the kingdom's fate, comes in October 1510. The Tunggu dynasty, situated in the southeast, secedes entirely from the Ava Federation.
The secession of Tunggu is the turning point. It is not just a loss of territory. It is a catastrophic loss of resources. Tunggu immediately drains Ava of crucial agricultural revenue.
And people, right?
Yes. Furthermore, because Tunggu is increasingly viewed as a stable, ascending power, it begins drawing away thousands of Burman refugees who are desperately fleeing the growing instability and violence on Ava's northern borders.
So Ava is rapidly bleeding its essential manpower and economic resources at the exact moment a massive, organized threat appears on the horizon.
And that threat comes straight out of the history we discussed earlier. The Confederation of Shan States mobilizes in the north. By the early 16th century, this massive military confederation is explicitly led by a warlord named Solon of Munyan.
Solon? Wait, that name traces back, doesn't it?
It does. Solon is the direct descendant of Sibufa, the very man the Ava court had allowed to slip away during their diplomatic negotiations with Ming China decades prior.
The younger brother they let go. Talk about a diplomatic mistake.
A fatal one. Solon harnesses the combined military power of the Mountain Confederation to launch a systematic, devastating invasion straight into the critically weakened Ava heartland.
The military balance of power had entirely shifted. Ava could no longer field the massive armies it once used to dominate the region.
No. And Solon recognized this weakness and drove his forces relentlessly south. In March 1527, the defensive lines finally collapse. Solon's forces breach the walls and brutally sack the city of Ava.
It's the end of an era?
During the chaotic street fighting, the ruling monarch, King Xuanangyashan, is killed in combat. Solon effectively dismantles the kingdom's independence and places his own son, Thohanbwa, on the throne of Ava as a puppet ruler.
And the era of Thohanbwa marks an incredibly dark and violent chapter in the region's history. He is entirely unaccustomed to the complex mechanics of administering a large, culturally sophisticated agrarian state.
He was a raider at heart.
Right. He grew up embedded in the raiding culture of the northern hills. Consequently, he attempts to maintain control over the Ava populace through extreme military terror, entirely abandoning the traditional methods of religious patronage and cultural legitimacy that had stabilized the kingdom for nearly two centuries.
Yes. Thohanbwa's administration was characterized by profound cultural vandalism. He viewed the massive religious infrastructure of Ava not as sacred sites of worship, but merely as hoards of unprotected wealth.
He just saw it as a bank to rob.
Exactly. The sources are absolutely clear on his brutality. He famously declared that the sacred pagodas were nothing more than secular treasure chambers. He ordered his troops to systematically pillage the temples, physically stripping them of their gold leaf, precious gems, and ancient relics.
That is deeply offensive to the population.
And when the monastic community inevitably protested this desecration, he responded with mass executions of the monks. In doing so, he completely alienated the entire cultural, intellectual, and religious foundation that the previous kings of Ava had spent two centuries meticulously building.
It is a complete inversion of the traditional Burmese kingship model. I mean, you cannot violently dismantle the religious core of a society and expect the political structure to hold.
It's just not going to work.
No. Such despotic rule, completely devoid of administrative or spiritual legitimacy, is structurally unsustainable. The Hanwha is forced to rely entirely on the perception of his invincible military prestige to keep his terrified subordinates in line. But that illusion shatters in 1542.
When he fights Tunggu.
Right. The Hanwha launches a campaign against the rapidly expanding Tunggu dynasty and suffers a massive, humiliating military defeat. Once his military prestige falters, his political position instantly becomes untenable.
The end of his reign is recorded as one of the most cinematic and brutal moments in the region's historical record. By May 1542, the internal dissent within his own court reaches a boiling point. The assassination is orchestrated by his own chief minister, a highly respected man named Yan Nang.
And the mechanics of the assassination are intensely dramatic, which brings us right back to how we started this deep dive. Yan Nang requests an audience with the king and formally presents him with the former Ava royal sword, the legendary Yan Wepa Da.
The Sword of the Kings.
Yes. As the Hanbo physically bows his head to closely examine the sacred blade, Yan Nang draws it and strikes the king dead in a single blow. It is a stunning, violent coup. But despite Yan Nang successfully eliminating the tyrant, the institutional reality is that the era of Ava's independence is already effectively over.
The state apparatus was completely shattered. Decades of relentless external conflict, massive territorial losses, and the profound internal mismanagement under Thohambra had thoroughly hollowed out the kingdom's administrative core.
There was nothing left to save.
Not really. The physical city of Ava lingers in a severely weakened, politically fractured state for roughly another decade. But the geopolitical center of gravity had permanently shifted south to the ascendant Tunggu dynasty.
And that leads to the final end.
The final blow arrives in January 1555, when King Beinong of the Tunggu dynasty marches north and decisively conquers the city. He formally integrates Upper Burma into the massive Second Burmese Empire, permanently ending Ava's reign as an independent kingdom.
You know, when we look back at the entire arc of this deep dive into the sources, we face a fascinating historical paradox. The Kingdom of Ava absolutely failed as a political and military entity in 1555. Its walls were breached, its kings were deposed or assassinated, and its armies were completely absorbed by the expanding Tunggu Empire.
Structurally, it was gone.
Yet the cultural weight of the name Ava remains so incredibly potent that for centuries afterward, foreign diplomats, European empires, and cartographers still refer to the entire region simply as the Court of Ava. It leaves you to consider how a state can fail so utterly on the battlefield and in its political structure, yet succeed so thoroughly in defining the cultural, literary, and intellectual identity of a region that the ghost of the kingdom completely outlives the very people who conquered it.
It is a profound testament to the enduring power of cultural infrastructure. The physical kingdom, the wooden palaces, and the shifting alliances of the mandala system eventually collapsed. But the deep cultural foundation, they engineered the democratization of vernacular literature, the deeply rooted religious institutions, and the very concept of a unified central state endured long after the political structure itself was shattered.
Thank you for listening. History Maps. Learn history visually.